Bobby Wayne Woods is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Stay with us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of Bobby Woods in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Dennis Longmire, Houston Vigil reporter Nancy Bailey, and special guest David Foti, head of the U.S. Program for Human Rights Watch. The Execution Watch begins.
You're listening to radio station KPFT Houston. This is the HD2 channel. You're also listening to executionwatch.org. That is our international worldwide web broadcast of the program. Every time Texas executes somebody, we gather in this studio and do a show about that execution. Tonight, Bobby Wayne Woods, age 44, is being executed by the state of Texas. The first thing we'll find out is the process going on? And Elizabeth will call Huntsville, Dennis Longmire, and advise us whether Bobby Wayne Woods' execution is progressing as normal. That usually means that the witnesses cross the road and go into the Walls unit in Huntsville. It's a relic. O. Henry actually lived there in his day, wrote short stories from a cell in the front of that building, and that building has been serving Texas prisoners since it was a Confederate prison back in the mid-1800s. It's been a state prison since it was recycled from war usage. Texas has also had a busy execution chamber. We've been executing people ever since we've been a republic and then a state. It used to happen outside the courthouse where after the trials, and a few weeks later after somebody had a reasonable opportunity to decide there weren't going to be any appeals, we'd carry them out and hang them from a tree or a gallows constructed individual courthouses around the state. Along about the 1920s, they moved the executions into the state responsibility as opposed to the county responsibility. And so that's when people were transported to Huntsville State Prison in Huntsville, and executions have occurred there. Death Row is actually located in Livingston, Texas, at the Polunsky Unit, and the death chamber is all that is in Huntsville, Texas. And so they bring inmates in as their date arrives. They're housed in one of five or six cells, with a few steps away from the execution chamber because sometimes that part of the prison business gets busy. And, on execution time, about 5 o'clock, they, march them in and put them on the gurney. They make the needles are placed in their veins, and then they allow the witnesses to come in. They open the curtains to observe the whole thing. The warden of the Huntsville unit is the official executioner for Texas, and the warden will be there, and at appropriate time he will give a signal to the executioner, who cannot be seen from the chamber by the person being executed or by the witnesses, and the signal is given after the final words, and death occurs shortly thereafter. Dennis?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Dennis!
I'm on the radio right now.
Yep, you're on the radio right now.
Hey, good morning. It's evening, isn't it?
Yes, it's evening. I imagine it's chilly in Huntsville.
It is chilly in a whole lot of different ways. Oddly enough, Ray, we're standing out here, about 13 or 14 of us, and on the wall of the Walls unit, there's a big poster saying Merry Christmas to all and a Happy New Year to all, and pictures of Santa Claus riding with his reindeer.
Oh, okay.
While we stand in vigil in opposition to the killing of a child.
Well, tell us how many folks you got out there.
I think 13 of us. There's a group of people from Texas A&M's Catholic youth group. They're here. They've been here on several different occasions. Dave Atwood is up here. He and his wife are here. And a couple of the regular vigilers. A man just from Germany just walked up. Pardon? Belgium just came up, and so there are some people from the international community here as well.
Well, does he speak English as well as Flemish?
Absolutely. You speak English. Would you like to speak to a radio show down in Houston? Hold on 1 second. Hey, I've got to get my phone out of my pocket and hand it over. 1 second.
All right. Dennis Longmire with his BlackBerry on. So that...
Hello?
Hello. Who are you? What's your name?
My name is Matthew.
Matthew, and you're from Belgium?
Yes, I'm from Belgium.
What brings you to the United States?
I am actually on a travel with my aunt and my cousin, and we are here for visiting a friend which is in the death row at the Polanski unit. My aunt has been writing to him since 10 years now, and she's 80 years old, and for the first time she came to Texas to meet him. And we're here to support him and support all prisoners who are in the death row as well. And also to give our support for against the death penalty.
Very good. They don't do that in your country, do they?
No, we don't. No, it has been abolished more than 30 years ago. And there has no been execution anymore for a long, long time.
And now your aunt is communicating with another inmate, and you're here for Bobby Woods because that's what was going on while you were here, right?
Yes, for us it's very unusual, and it's we do not understand it, and that's why we come and stand for it.
Well, you've certainly got some good company. Dennis Longmire is a professor at the university there, and he's the person that gave you the phone.
Uh-huh.
And he can guide you through this morbid process. It's actually very ritualized. But every time they do that in Huntsville, we here at KPFT go on the air on HD2 channel and do a program concerning the execution. When you get home, you can go to the Internet to executionwatch.org and hear this interview.
Okay. I would be glad to. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for expressing your opinion and your support for these.
No, thank you. You're welcome. It's a pleasure for me.
Okay, thank you. Put Dennis back on. Trying to get back.
You're still there.
Yeah, I'm still here. Dennis, is that you?
Yes, it is.
Have the witnesses crossed? Is everything?
No. So far, there has still been no action from the witnesses going in yet. So whatever is going on has slowed it up a little bit. Maybe, hopefully, we'll stop it.
Yeah, by now, normally, a normal procedure, the witnesses would have crossed the road.
Exactly. By now, the witnesses would be already in the witness room at this time. They would have crossed the road about 10 minutes ago. So the last we heard, and we heard this from one of the news reporters from the Dallas station who's going to be witnessing, that there were three appeals that were still pending. I don't know what they were based on, but there is that hope that we still stand here prayerfully contemplating.
Okay, Dennis, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ring off, and we're going to discuss the case. Elizabeth, you know how to reach her on her cell phone. Yeah. As soon as something happens or doesn't happen, we'll be back in touch with you.
Very good. I will call if any action happens, I will call Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Okay. Good luck. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Jim?
Yes?
You got any speculation what's going on?
Well, what happened, the Fifth Circuit turned down an appeal because what had happened, because, you know, the big issue in this case
sure.
is the fact that he's mentally retarded, and the University of Texas professor wanted to do a video to support his claim, do a video of Bobby Wayne Woods to show how mentally defective he was, to support his claim that he wasn't competent. And TDC officials would not allow him to video Bobby Wayne Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fifth Circuit affirmed that, and I'm assuming what happened, that part has been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, is whether or not they can video him. Video Woods is a part of the claim that he is mentally retarded. I'm sure that's one of the issues that's gone up to the Supreme Court.
How rare is it for basically an ancillary issue about a process, not... So the issue is not, is a man retarded or not? The issue is, can we do a videotape to so the court can see with their own eyes?
Right. What they're saying in this particular case, they want to use this in evidence at another competency hearing. The problem with this, there has really been three competency hearings. And there have been three competency hearings thus far.
Yeah.
There was one initially. The case was reversed. Another one was done. It was scheduled for execution not long ago. That was stayed pending more investigation into incompetency. And this is about the third or fourth time around. And thus far, they've lost that issue every time. And I'm skeptical that something will be done about it because after three.
So basically, this issue has been pretty well plowed.
Right. Very well plowed.
Okay. This is one case. I mean, sometimes we come in here and there's not been a lot of paper wasted on a case, but this one, apparently, there was a good bit written.
They wore out four out of four. They did a lot of work on this case.
And this is not a pretty case.
No.
Tell us what happened, Jim.
What happened when Bobby Wayne Woods was 32 years old, he was dating a woman by the name of Shawana Patterson, or living with her. And she had two children. She had an 11-year-old girl named Sarah and a 9-year-old boy by the name of, what is his name? A 9-year-old boy named Cody. And what happened, there was some split up in the relationship, and he got kicked out of the house.
Yeah.
And late one night, Bobby Wayne Woods goes back to the house late at night and
hopped up
and climbed through the window. Hit the little girl in the chest, and there was a struggle, and apparently from the evidence, he did some sort of sexual contact with her, because they found semen in the blanket, and later on semen in her vagina. And he abducted both children. What's interesting about this is that the mother apparently heard the children's cries when they were being abducted by Woods and did nothing, because she later ended up pleading guilty to injury to a child by omission and got 8 years in the penitentiary. And what that basically means, injury to a child, one was murdered, one was hurt severely, and by omission means she did nothing. And so what happened, she ended up getting 8 years later on. Now what happened after he kidnapped the two children, he drove them to a graveyard, took the little boy out of the car, in front of the car, and tried to strangle him. He lost consciousness, and he hit him some, and apparently let him go, or laid him down. And then the little girl, Sarah, began to yell and scream and cry, and said she's going to report him to the police for assaulting her brother. He then took the girl and claimed he drove away, and claimed he had a knife to her throat, and that she turned her head, and her throat was accidentally cut. That story didn't sell too well because her throat, in fact, had been cut, but is a severe cut. Mm-hmm. I mean, it cut through her larynx, major artery, so it's an extremely deep cut. And the likelihood of someone just turning their head and cutting their throat is not too likely based on the severity of the injury. And he hit her somewhere in the woods. In the meantime, the little boy regained consciousness. And he managed to find a cowboy out riding a horse, exercising his horse, signaled to him. Cowboy found him. He then told the police what had happened. The police began to look for Bobby Wayne Woods because at that point they knew that both children had been kidnapped. And I never could find out. I'm assuming the mother never called the police, never reported the fact that her children had been abducted, because they learned about this apparently the first time from Cody, the little 9-year-old boy.
Hmm.
And then at this point, they tracked down Bobby Wayne Woods, and he said that he's going to lead them to the body, but she wasn't alive because he cut her throat. And that's when he initially said that she had turned her head and he accidentally cut her throat. He led them to the body and they found her. She had on no underwear and, was, of course, her throat had been cut and she was dead. At trial, what he did is he recanted his confession, took the stand and testified. And he said he tried to blame all of it on a cousin who had later after the crime had committed suicide. He tried to lay the blame off on him. But all the evidence seemed to point toward him, primarily because his blood with semen was found on the girl's blanket, not the cousin's. The butcher knife used that he had, that they found, that he led them to, had the little girl's blood on it, was found in a garbage sack that he had borrowed from a neighbor. Plus, there was a pawn ticket in the same garbage sack where the butcher knife was that contained a pawn ticket for items he'd earlier stolen from the house. Apparently, he'd been in and out of the house several times. Plus, what really hurt him during the trial, the state introduced a diary. And apparently, Woods had been sexually molesting the 11-year-old girl over a period of time. because she had a sexually transmitted disease the same as he had, plus she wrote in her diary about him sexually molesting her, and that's what really hurt him. And there was no evidence, according to all the people that investigated this case, that more than one person was involved in this crime, although he did try to blame the cousin for it.
But the cousin was not alive to...
No, to no. You know, he, apparently the cousin committed suicide shortly after the murders, hanged himself, and no one really knows the reason for that. At least he apparently left no note saying he felt guilty about anything. He just one of those things. Maybe it's too much East Texas. He just hanged himself.
Jim, can you have any speculations about this guy's mental capacity?
Well, here's what happened. On the initial direct appeal, the mental capacity was never an issue at trial. And the reason sometimes lawyers don't do that, as I've said many, many times on this program, when you say that somebody is retarded or they have a mental problem and they kill somebody, that also is incentive, although it may create some sympathy, it's also incentive for a jury to kill somebody and get the death penalty because they're fearful the person will repeat that same conduct again because there's no cure for someone being mentally defective. And that cuts both ways. Now, whether the lawyers consider this at trial, I simply don't know, but it was never an issue. And what happened on the first direct appeal, they just did what we call the traditional death penalty appeal. They argued over, number one, there's a thing called a Simmons issue. Back during that period of time, the jurors weren't told that a life sentence meant a 40 flat years or you could be eligible for parole. Yeah. They weren't told that. They argued on that point, and there's always been this argument going up because, as you well know, the way they assess the death penalty, the jury doesn't say we vote to kill you. They answer a series of questions, mm-hmm. and one of them is a mitigating question. And there's no burden of proof, meaning neither side has to they just have to present evidence. Nobody has a burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And that case has been argued, that issue has been argued 1,000 times. They've always lost it. And it wasn't even an issue on direct appeal. Now, what happened after his case was affirmed on direct appeal, Atkins came out, the Supreme Court case of Atkins, in which the Supreme Court ruled that it violated the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment to execute a retarded person. So at this point, they go back in and file a state writ, and at that point, they claim that he's mentally retarded. And they developed, apparently, a pretty thorough hearing. And it's true of all of these cases. The evidence went both ways. What the state presented was a series of psychologists and psychiatrists who had examined him on times past, all of whom said he was partially retarded, but not retarded as per the requirement of Atkins. Because what happened, the big problem with Atkins, it just simply said you can't execute somebody retarded, but gave no guidelines to the state of what retarded meant. So Texas, in a case called Ex parte Brasino, set out three things that you've got to prove that you're mentally retarded. One of them, you've got to have an IQ below 70. Number two, you've got to have a lack of adaptive skills, meaning you can't flip hamburgers at McDonald's and can't dress yourself. And number two, these two things, lack of adaptive skill and an IQ of 70.
It's not either or, it's both.
It's both. And lack of these two traits have to occur before you reach the age of 18. In other words, there's got to be a history of it. It can't be something you can feign after you become an adult. And so, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Jim, but I just heard from the Attorney General's office that the Supreme Court turned down Bobby Wood's appeal just a few minutes ago.
And so the process is like, why don't you get Dennis back on the horn and we'll talk about it.
That doesn't surprise me at all that they did that. As I said earlier, I didn't think they'd ever grant a stay in this case, another stay in this case. And then what happens, you've got to be able to prove this occurred before you reach the age of 18. There's got to be a history of this. It's not something you develop after you get on death row. But when they had the initial hearing, the writ hearing, because they had apparently a pretty thorough hearing, the state called virtually all of Bobby Wayne Wood's school teachers. None of them said he was in special classes, and none of them said he was retarded, didn't appear to be retarded. They had a series of different tests that he had been given. There was nothing as early.
He didn't go very far in school.
No. But little time he went, the teacher said he was not mentally retarded. Plus, there's about three or four psychologists that examined him during all of this period of time and said he was not mentally retarded. Then you got one defense psychologist who claimed that he is, in fact, mentally retarded. See, the problem is, plus they called some of his employers. He worked at some fast food place. And they said he was a real good cook, had no problem taking orders, had no problem doing the cooking. So you don't have a history of someone having an IQ of 70 or below before the age of 18.
And you don't have a problem of lacking adaptive
skills. Exactly. And those are the real big problems that they had in the initial writ hearing. And then you got one psychologist, and plus all this overwhelming evidence of employers saying he had adaptive skills, teachers saying that he wasn't retarded, no history of school records showing he had an IQ below 70.
Actually, he was interviewed recently, and a journalist, former news director at KPFT, now a student at Columbia University's journalism school, Renee Phelps, interviewed him, and that interview is available on several sources. Part of it was played on Democracy Now! This morning, and Renee has it up on the web. If you find Renee Phelps and get her reports, that may be a Facebook listening post. But to me, he sounded like a person who has trouble with what he called big words, words with more than four or five letters.
Like George Bush.
Yeah, like George Bush. And you know, there's considerable evidence that retardation is around and you can still function even as President of the United States under that category. But at any rate, for the listeners who want to hear that, you can go to Democracy Now! Or you can search Renee Phelps, P-H-E-L-P-S, and have a look at that interview and decide for yourself. But apparently Elizabeth is in there trying to get Dennis Longmire back on the phone, and we'll see if the witnesses have crossed the road and if this process is going to continue in Huntsville today. And any word from Dennis? Nothing is visibly happening in Huntsville. Why don't you and I wait and talk some more after
Sure.
we find out what's happening here. And, get David on, and we'll chat with David. David and Elizabeth and I recently had breakfast. Interesting fellow. He is kind of an activist on the business of executions and homicides, the history of homicides in America. And so we'll get Dennis on and chat with him. David is the director of the United States Program for Human Rights Watch. He's a civil rights lawyer who specializes in the death penalty and other criminal justice issues. Human Rights Watch seeks to defend and protect human rights by focusing international attention where rights are violated, holding oppressors accountable. But in this case, in the case of Bobby Wayne Woods, there is a lot of stuff, a lot of appellate opinions in this case dealing with the issues that were reported here this evening. The story is pretty gruesome, and it makes one wonder about the sanity leading up to that. But once these things happen, it becomes a continuum. It's very difficult to explain complex and really alarming criminal behavior to the unwatched public, but what happens is things start going downhill and they spiral completely out of control. And that's not unusual, is it, Jim?
But here's one thing that makes me a little bit skeptical about the initial writ hearing, and this is just a fact of life. This occurred in a little town called Granbury in East Texas. And as you well know, East Texas is an extremely conservative religious community, and they're very clannish over there. In fact, East Texas is more like Georgia and Alabama than it is like the rest of Texas.
Yeah.
And so what happens in cases like this, because the murder is so heinous, people like teachers, people who live in that community are going to come forward and support the state. And they could all be lying through their teeth because it's part of a system where the whole society thinks he's committed a heinous act, and they know and realize that they testify that, in fact, they thought he was retarded, they'd be shunned by everybody in the community because they would look upon that as somebody...
A traitor.
Well, they look upon it as somebody supporting a killer. And so it makes you a little bit skeptical of the testimony presented at the writ hearing because it all came from people who lived in the community where the murder occurred, a very clannish community. And as a general rule, it's amazing how people will stretch the truth when they feel like someone's a bad person. And that the idea of somebody in East Texas standing up and doing something to support the defense is almost unheard of in these small towns, especially in a crime where a little girl has been sexually assaulted and killed, her throat cut, and her younger brother almost strangled to death. And like I say, they were so outraged by this, they even put the mother in the penitentiary.
Yeah.
So I'm skeptical of that. Plus, one of the claims later on during the process of the writs was that the lawyer who handled the habeas hearing on the insanity mental retardation issue was ill-prepared to do it because he let the state use a lot of old antiquated IQ tests. He didn't investigate the background of the IQ tests that had previously been given. That was one of the issues brought up in federal court, that the appellate lawyer who handled the writ lawyer that handled the hearing on the mental retardation was not competent. Plus, the same guy that handled that writ hearing had been sanctioned. In fact, he's no longer ready. No longer let him try and file any more writs on behalf of defendants because he's filed writs late, been sanctioned by federal courts, and been booted out of the process. He cannot file any more writs. Court of Criminal Appeals won't let him.
Well, where did he likely come from? Court appointed?
Fort Worth. I think he was from Fort Worth.
But he was correctly
court appointed. Court appointed. Sure. The Court of Criminal Appeals now has a system where they can pay lawyers to do writs. And so they have done that. So.
All right. And so Elizabeth's going to put David on. David?
Yes. Hello.
Good to hear from you.
It's good to hear your voice too, Ray.
And I remember we had breakfast not long ago, and then you went on with the rest of your life. Are you familiar with this case? Are you familiar with the Woods case?
I'm not familiar with this case. I told Elizabeth that, you know, I'm happy to talk about, the death penalty and mental retardation in general, but I just was not able to get up to speed on this.
Okay. Well, actually, the audience, we've kind of referred the audience to available material that they can get on their own. A very fine journalist and former news director here at KPFT, Renee Phelps, actually recently interviewed Mr. Woods, and they can hear Mr. Woods' own voice in this matter. We're in kind of a holding pattern because even though the Attorney General's office said the Supreme Court just a few minutes ago refused to grant a stay, the issue of the witnesses crossing the road, which is our tip that the procedure has begun, is still not happened. There's no visible evidence that this execution is continuing. So what I would like for you to do is talk generally about the position of you and your organization about how these mental retardation issues. You see, I'm sitting here talking to Jim, and it's obvious to me that there are no bright lines.
Right.
That can give you any hint, and it's always an adversarial situation. So you have somebody saying crazy, not crazy, and finger pointing, and often the lawyers get blamed for stuff. So why don't you talk about that and how confusing that is in the execution business?
Okay, well, I mean, you're going to ask me questions, right? But I'm
sure.
You know, yes, I'm happy to talk about that more generally.
Okay, well, what kinds of past experiences have you run into in this area?
Well, let me sort of back up a step. It's obviously a very positive thing that the Supreme Court in the Atkins case ruled that people with mental retardation can't be executed. But every time the court draws a line, there are going to be some cases that fall agonizingly close to that line, and the results in those cases are going to seem arbitrary and unfair, and in fact they are. And that's one reason why we believe that the solution to this conundrum is simply to stop tinkering with the machinery of death, as Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun once said, and simply to abolish the death penalty altogether.
Okay, and is the confusion justification for considering the whole thing? I mean, the abolition of executions, is the confusion about the issue of mental retardation sufficiently cloudy? I mean, the Supreme Court says, all right, you can't execute people who are retarded. And then the next thing you know, you've got to make a determination of what that means. And then what does that mean in this particular case as opposed to that case? And so you really haven't created a new standard. You've created a bunch of new questions. Is that an inherent fog-making machine that deals with the criminal justice system in these ultimate punishments?
You know, I think what it does, what these cases illustrate, is the ultimate impossibility of coming up with any morally defensible way of deciding who lives and who dies. Because, as I said, there will be people who are clearly mentally retarded. There will be people who are clearly not mentally retarded. But there will be many people for whom it's not at all clear. The definition, it's not like whether someone is 6 feet tall or not. It's multifactorial. There is an element of clinical judgment involved on the part of the evaluating psychologist or psychiatrist. And so, as I say, you will end up with cases that look very similar, defendants who look very similar, and yet some will live and some will die. And that is just not a morally defensible result under any system I'm familiar with.
Well, you know, earlier we had a gentleman on who was at the vigil in Huntsville, and he is from Belgium. And he said that they haven't had any executions in his country in more than 30 years, and when you go back 30 years ago, and Belgium itself was a very different place with a different kind of regime. But we're stuck out here. America is not where other people are on these issues. And is life less safe in Belgium because they don't have the execution than it is in Houston, Texas, where we do have execution?
No, I mean, as you say, the United States is really a global outlier on this issue, and every one of our peer nations, Canada, Great Britain, Germany, France, Belgium, abolished the death penalty decades ago. And in our continued enthusiastic practice of the death penalty, we stand in the company of countries like China, and Iran and Saudi Arabia, not countries whose political systems we generally like to compare ours to. And at the same time, abolitionist countries like Canada, Western Europe, have much lower homicide rates than the United States. I mean, if the death penalty prevented homicide, Texas should have no murders. And
should have had any in the last 30 years.
Exactly.
David, how do people get in touch with your organization and find out more about Human Rights Watch?
Well, Human Rights Watch is an international human rights organization. We work in about 80 countries at any given time, including the United States, and we have a whole division of our organization just devoted to human rights violations in the United States. And, of course, one of those and one of our priority issues in the United States is the death penalty. We work to abolish the death penalty wherever it still exists. And so we can be found on the web at www.hrw.org, and if you click on United States, it will take you to our work on this country.
David, as far as Human Rights Watch is concerned, when the United States Supreme Court handed down the decision in Atkins, were you expecting a clearer result, or was this confusion envisioned?
You know, I think it's it was not surprising, let me put it that way, simply because the evaluation of, and it's not like, for example, the case the Supreme Court decided 3 years later in which they said people who committed their crimes before the age of 18 can't be executed. You know, there's very rarely any dispute over whether someone's 18 or not. There is, as you've discussed, often substantial dispute over whether someone is mentally retarded or not. It's just not a clear-cut yes or no determination. And so I think that a certain amount of lack of specificity was almost inevitable given the subject matter of what the court was dealing with.
Well, isn't the 18-year-old rule an indication that people have to reach a certain level of maturity before they are culpable or responsible?
Well, exactly. And the two opinions are really, although they were written by different justices, they're really quite similar in that respect, in that in both opinions you have the court saying, we reserve the death penalty for the most culpable. Not all criminals, indeed, not even all murderers, receive the death penalty. It is for the most culpable defendants in our system. And people who do not have a fully formed mental capacity, people who are unable or less able to plan, to exercise judgment, to control their impulses, to foresee the consequences of their actions, those people are by definition not among most culpable. And that describes both children and people with mental retardation. So, yes, the two cases, although on the surface they deal with different populations, so the rationale is very similar. Also with the issue of deterrence, these are both groups that because of their diminished ability to plan, to foresee the future, are less likely to be deterred by the prospect of the death penalty than a normal, mature adult. And so that's another reason the court relied on in the Atkins case to invalidate the death penalty for people with mental retardation.
All right. But just because a person is not 18 years of age and therefore cannot be executed doesn't mean that that same person can't be locked up for life without hope of parole, which is just execution in the slow form.
Well, that very issue, as I'm sure you now you know, is now before the Supreme Court in a case that was argued, two cases actually, from Florida that were argued on November 9th, bringing an Eighth Amendment challenge to putting children, sentencing children to life without parole. And in those cases, actually, it was for non-homicide crimes, for crimes in which no one was killed. So so we will see what the court does with that. But that is similarly, of course, a very severe punishment, particularly for a young person.
Well, is there something about American constitutional law as opposed to, say, common law? That means that every time the Supreme Court makes a decision, they complicate rather than simplify matters.
Well, I think it gets back to the problem of drawing lines. And many people, including Justice Harry Blackmun, who started a Republican appointed by President Nixon, started out on the Supreme Court as a supporter of the death penalty. By the end of his career, threw up his hands and said, there is, you know, I have tried for 20-some years to fashion a reasonable, defensible way of deciding these cases and distinguishing who shall live and who shall die, and I have concluded that it is impossible. Justice Stevens, another Republican appointee who's still on the court, seems to have come to a similar conclusion, that there is simply no fair and rational and morally justifiable way to decide who lives and who dies. And so I think that you're right. Whenever the court takes a step that exempts some people from the death penalty but not others, you're going to end up with cases that fall very close to that line in which the results seem very difficult to justify.
Where are you, David? Where's your offices?
Our international headquarters is based in New York. I myself, director of the U.S. program, am based in Washington, D.C.
So you're relatively close to the Supreme Court.
Just down the road, in fact.
So you go there every once in a while.
Yes, certainly whenever there's a death case, or I was there to watch the argument in the juvenile life without parole case last month.
What impresses you when you go there when these matters are considered? The architecture is overwhelming, if the listeners did not know that. It's kind of like going to where the gods are in Pergamum and taking a look around. The architecture is phenomenal. But what impresses you about the seriousness with which the justices take these matters?
You know, sometimes they seem to take them very seriously indeed. Other times, less so. I think it may be that, unfortunately, execution has and the death penalty have become such a familiar part of our culture in this country that they no longer always elicit the gravity that that they should.
Optimistic, pessimistic about the future of this
long
issue.
Run, very optimistic. We've seen two states abolish the death penalty just in the last 2 years, New Mexico and New Jersey. There are now 15 states in the country that are abolitionists, including some large states like Michigan and New York, and the trend is toward abolition. It took decades for the rest of the world to turn its back on the death penalty and to leave the United States as one of the last holdouts. That didn't happen overnight. It took time. And similarly, in this country, there's a lot of cause for hope. The number of new death sentences being imposed, which is really the best indicator of people's support for the death penalty. The number of new death sentences being imposed is at about one-third the level that it was in the mid-90s. The fact that we've had more than 130 people on death row, some of whom came very close to execution, later exonerated as innocent, has really shaken the confidence of a lot of people in the reliability of the death penalty system. And finally, at a time when crushing budget deficits are causing major cuts in government services, the expense of the death penalty seems harder and harder to justify. So we will get there. We will see the day when the United States joins the rest of its peer nation in abolishing the death penalty. It will not be tomorrow or the day after, but we're making progress, and we will get there.
Thank you very much, David Fathi, who is the director of the United States Program for Human Rights Watch. Thank you very much, David.
And thank you.
Bye-bye. And the website for that is http://www.hrw.org. Well, could you hear much of that, Jim?
Let me tell you a couple of observations, and nobody's talked about this. Years ago, there was some talk about taking these issues away from a jury. Because really, an issue of insanity, an issue of incompetency, an issue of mental retardation is a medical issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not subject to, you don't have a jury decide whether you've got cancer or not.
Yeah.
You don't call some doctor saying he does, some say he doesn't. And I think one of the solutions that we should carefully look at is take the issue of insanity, incompetence, and mental retardation out of the adversarial process and let that decision be handled by a board of doctors where you don't have presenting evidence, you don't have evidence arguing on either side, because it's a medical
issue. It
shouldn't
be an adversarial process.
No, it makes sense to be adversarial. What does a jury know about insanity?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have insanity to see if you don't have a jury to determine if you have measles or not. That's a medical question. And I think the move, there should be some serious consideration, because it's all, you could always find a psychiatrist who'll say whatever you want him to say. And truth of the matter is, most experts, wherever the money is, are going to say that. That's one of the unfortunate things about it. And I just don't think it should be a part of the adversarial process. It's not geared for it. And it should be done by a panel of psychiatrists or a panel of psychologists.
All right. Dennis is on the phone, so we'll punch him up. Dennis.
Yes, Ray.
What has happened?
Well, all of the witnesses have gone in. In fact, about 15 minutes ago, the last group of witnesses went in. And so everyone is here waiting for them to come back out. And so that's all that's happened.
So actually the process began about half hour late.
Yes, it seems like it was approximately a half an hour later than usual.
Okay, and so by normal standards, witnesses would be in 20, 25 minutes and then file back out across the street.
Correct, that's so, right. And so we're anticipating them coming out anytime soon. The second group that went in, the witnesses for Bobby Woods went in a little bit later than the witnesses for the media. There was a longer delay between the two groups, which suggests to me that maybe there's somebody in the group of witnesses for Bobby who's older or having a problem, was just having some difficulty getting in. But I don't know that for certain. It just appeared that way to me.
Well, did they appear to be family witnesses or...?
Well, it's so far and it's dark right now, it's hard to say exactly who they were. And there is nobody down here on the corner who's had any direct contact with Bobby's family. And so what the person who's from Belgium who you spoke with, the woman who is the pen pal of Felix Rocha, R-O-C-H-A.
Rocha, yeah.
Who, he's from Houston. He's on death row. And she's been corresponding with Felix for 11 years. She said that Bobby had the cell directly next door to him before being moved to the death watch. And so he was quite upset about the execution today when they met with him.
Okay. Well, I suppose it's just a matter of time until we see the return of the witnesses. You might give Elizabeth a vote so she can make an announcement of that, but I want to thank Dennis Longmire, who is professor of criminal justice at University of Sam Houston University. Incidentally, I'm going to be on campus tomorrow.
You will be?
Dennis, yes, I'll be giving a lecture in Dr. Bruce's class.
Pretty good. Maybe I'll try to make it over
there. If you get a chance to come over there, John Endo and I do a duet performance for psychology and CJ classes.
And what time is that, Ray?
I think our lecture begins at 9 o'clock.
Okay. I will be attending a funeral.
He's going to pick me up at 6, and so I'll be traveling up that way. But maybe if you can make it back to campus from the services, we'll get a chance to coffee up.
I'll try to do that.
Thank you.
Let you know when anything happens up here.
Appreciate letting Elizabeth know. We'll probably just make an announcement about it,
sure,
and we'll bring you back on air.
Okay, very good.
Thank you. And that was Professor Dennis Longmire, who is a professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State and is frequently there keeping company with the vigils. He tells me that no one in that crowd has a direct connection to Bobby, but it was a pretty good-sized crowd. Had some Texas A&M students over for the occasion, as well as some folks from Europe. And it is rare that they have an execution in Huntsville that there's not a group of people. There's also a group of people somewhere in Houston, probably out at the convent on Alameda Street at OST, that are also in vigil, and there are vigils being conducted in Dallas and Austin. Today, every time there is an execution, some people gather in their cities, and inclement weather usually doesn't discourage them. Jim, who's been footing the bill for all of these appeals? Is it the county?
Nobody. University of Texas has a professor doing it. They got a probably an innocence project.
Well, no. I mean, on the other side. I mean, somebody's paying lawyers on both sides.
Oh, the attorney general takes over after the direct appeal is over with, and after the writs are done, the attorney general steps in.
Okay, but somebody, what's the name of this town we had here? Somebody in Burleson? No. What was the town where this all came from?
Granbury.
Somebody in that county initially footed the cost of the trial.
You have a large number of lawyers who will donate pro bono time to do this. You have a lot of lawyers, yeah. Lawyers that will do that. So it's either pro bono lawyers or somebody from some type of foundation, like Innocence Project, somebody that's funded. And in cases like the Professor University of Texas, I'm sure they have some funding for it.
So this is not really one of those. But still, somebody spent a lot of volunteer time. And a lot of energy that could have been doing other resourceful things in this struggle, right?
Exactly.
Jim Skelton is, of course, the guy who comes down here and helps us understand all of this. And, Jim, although you do a wonderful job, I frequently leave somewhat confused.
Well, I'm going to make a comment. You were talking earlier, and this is what so frustrates me about law. For example, the Supreme Court case you mentioned, a cutoff age of 18.
Yeah.
The problem is, and it seems awful hypocritical, because you can have somebody under the age of 18 who commits a crime, and they'll certify them as an adult because they claim they had the maturity of an adult and should be tried as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
But the converse is not true. If somebody is 18 or above and has the mental age of a 6-year-old or has the mental capacity of somebody under the age of 18, they will not certify him back to juvenile court. And it seems terribly unfair to me because you don't all of a sudden get smart when you get 18. Because I remember a tragic case that I tried to help a family in which their kid had been injured at childbirth, and he had the hormones of a 19-year-old boy but the brain of a 6-year-old kid that was controlling it.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to argue that very same issue, that he should not be handled as an adult, because although chronologically he was 19, mentally he was 6 years old.
Jim, I know people like that.
And it seems to me terribly unfair that they have some arbitrary number like 18, and when you can certify somebody under 18 to be an adult, by the same token, the reverse should be true, that if somebody is mentally not 18, he should not be tried as an adult and should be tried like a juvenile. And I never thought that was fair. And that's what bothers me about the 18-year-old case, because they've never done that. They've never permitted us to go into court because somebody is mentally not 18 and use that as a defense. But they can use the other. If he's mature enough, they can certify him over and put him in the pen.
Could a DA sort those things out?
No, the legislature would have to.
The DA doesn't have the authority.
No. All the DA can do is follow the law laid down by the legislature. And see, and the problem with Supreme Court cases, especially in this case of mental retardation, there's a whole bunch. When it first came out, I was furious when the opinion came out. Because, number one, because you're entitled to a jury to decide mental retardation if it comes up before trial.
Yeah.
On a writ hearing, you're not. Mm-hmm. No jury's permitted. And I said back then, if they let states handle the mental retardation issue during the during the punishment phase, when they have already heard the facts,
mm-hmm.
you're never going to find somebody mentally retarded, because the juries won't, because they know the horror of the facts that occurred. To me, the mental retardation issue should be settled prior to the trial, and the jury should not be informed about the horrible facts of the case, because it's going to influence their decision
in every case.
It's just
without a doubt.
And no question about that.
And that's basically what we're dealing with here.
And what they're doing in Texas, if you bring it up at the trial level, then it becomes an issue at punishment. Well, at punishment, they've already found he intentionally killed somebody. And then you have all the horror of the facts, like the gruesome facts of this case. And the juries don't care if he's mentally retarded. In fact, on anything, it gives them more impetus to kill somebody because he's retarded. And I thought that was terribly unfair. Number two, the states have gone 20 different directions on what is mentally retarded. California, for example, I think New York Times reported this today. They had a guy who had an IQ of 84, and they said he was retarded.
In California.
But in Texas, we've had guys of IQs under 70, like 60, 66, and things like that. And they said he's not mentally retarded under the Atkins case. And both of them have been upheld by the courts. And they're going to have to do something. And again, I think the solution, I've always felt the solution would be, an issue like this should not be subject to an adversarial proceeding. It is not lent itself to an adversarial proceeding. It should be done by people who are competent to handle this issue, not juries. And it should be done by a board of psychiatrists. Maybe three or four psychiatrists. Maybe they have to have an odd number. Either three to five psychiatrists on a board should make that determination. And it should be made based upon the medical facts without lawyers presenting evidence of the horrible facts of the case. Because, like I said before, a jury doesn't decide if you have cancer, the measles, or tonsillitis. Doctors do that. So by the same token, if somebody's insane or incompetent or retarded, how can a jury or how can lawyers make that determination? They're not trained to do so.
Or citizens.
Or citizens. Of course. And that's just foolishness to me. I always thought that was foolishness.
But human lives be terminated by execution or locked up forever?
See, I think, to me, I'm real offended about this life without parole because, as you said before, it's just another way to kill somebody. It just takes a longer time to do it. But dead is dead. And I think life without parole is as heinous as the death. It is a death penalty. It's just a different form of it.
Being an old ex-convict, I am as concerned with, I wouldn't want to go back there and spend the rest of my life.
Of course not.
That's no way to do that. What have we got? Dennis? Okay, is he back or do you have an announcement? Okay, either way.
Hello.
Dennis?
Yeah.
Dennis?
Hello?
The process has completed?
Yes, the process has completed. In fact, all of the people who were here on vigil, except two of us, have all taken off to try to find a warmer place. Just as you called me, two guys came out who also had witnessed, and I'm pretty sure they are the sheriff and maybe one of the attorneys from Dallas. They're law enforcement looking types.
Yeah.
I saw them go in earlier, so they were actually witnesses.
Okay, well, thank you very much and you go find some coffee. You need to thaw out.
Okay, I shall do that. Thank you for everything that you're doing.
Bye-bye. So at this point in time, we can certainly announce that Bobby Wayne Woods is dead. He was subject to a homicide of lethal injection. That's what it says on the death certificate. He died of homicide, legal execution in the state of Texas. And it is talking with Jim, it's so invaluable. All of this business of there's a bright line at 18, but only if you are under 18, if you are mentally below that, and chances
no
are
relief.
Bobby Woods would be less than 18 years old.
I would imagine he doesn't have the mentality of an 18-year-old, would be my guess.
Yeah, and so that's the way that is. That is Texas, and that's the execution business. My name is Ray Hill. I want to thank Jim Skelton for helping bring some light into this darkness. Elizabeth Stein is our executive producer, and she makes all this happen and hunts these folks down. We had a guest, David Fati. David is with Human Rights Watch. None of this would be possible at all if we didn't have Otis McClay to put all the technical skills together. And I've watched the audience rise and fall during the course of the thing, and thank you for listening to us on executionwatch.org. I am Ray Hill. This is KPFT Houston HD2 channel. Good night.